Guys, we are here on the Poetry Hood podcast, and I'm really excited about this episode. We're going to be talking about something that, to be honest, I don't know much about, or if any, and that is Ghazal. And we're also going to be discovering a new poet, and his name is Faraz. Did I say that correctly?
Absolutely.
And with us here today as well is a previous guest on the podcast, Namal Siddiqui. And she's going to be also partaking in the conversation with Faraz.
Thank you, Jamil.
How was that for an intro?
That was great.
That's good.
No, thank you very much. And I'm very excited that we're all sitting over here and going to talk about something very interesting, ghazals, especially because the origin of ghazals is Arabic. So we'll talk about that. But welcome, Faraz Ali, to the show.
Thank you.
So yeah, let's just start with you. Tell us a bit about yourself. Who is Faraz Ali?
Who is Faraz Ali? I'm still trying to figure that out. But Faraz Ali, in a nutshell, I am an experiential designer, but I'm also designing experiences in public realm, which is a physical world that we live in. So I do projects, I design spaces and experiences. And then I design experiences in the digital world. How do people navigate through those digital interface and how do they experience a service? And the third is that I design experiences in the poetic realm. Hmm. People used to think that, I do design as a full-time job, but maybe it's something that I don't like, and I'm passionate about literature and poetry. But for me, they both have been exactly the same thing. And recently I was reading about this expression in Arabic, Umm al-Fanun, and someone was explaining that poetry is Umm al-Fanun, the mother of all arts. And I really feel that all other creative expressions that I actually made in the field of design, they are pretty much I was trained and educated by poetry and the history of literature and ghazal as a tradition in particular. So, yeah, whatever I do in my leisure time, it actually informs what I do in professional life. And I think it adds so much value because my design work is all about human-centric design. Mm. And poetry allows me to ask really important questions about people. How do we think? How do we feel? And through poetry, I also use it as a means to go out and work with the community, understand the community. So since I'm designing for people and designing for community, and I have poetry as a medium to learn about people and the experiences of people and vice versa, because design allows me to question that how do people experience and how do you take elements and you put them together, and you can put them together in many different ways to create different experiences. So it allows me to deconstruct and look at poetry and read poetry in a very different way. So when I go to people and I try to do community readings and I try to do them in a very interactive manner, I go there with my prompts, which allows them to navigate through the poetic realm. In a way, that's how I'm balancing the two.
One thing that comes to my mind while you were speaking is that writing poetry or designing these I'm imagining when you say digital space, it's like website, applications. It's like how people are going to perceive or experience that thing. So when you're designing these things, you have people's perception in mind. And I think that's probably similar to when people write poetry as well. They're thinking, how will people perceive what I'm writing? Do you have poems that you've written that you don't think about how people will perceive it? Or is that all your poetry is like that? Or do you have a mix of both? Maybe there are poems that you don't publicize.
I have a mix of both. I actually write certain poems which are specifically for my own self. I see most of them as mental exercises. I take a concept or a thought or an idea and I try to actually put it into some, because I feel like some poems, they come as a melody. So you need to kind of ride that melody and try to capture that thought. But some poems, they actually are they come with a title. They come with a very specific agenda. They come with a purpose. And that's actually I'll talk more about it when we will talk more about ghazals. That sometimes that's what basically ghazals are like. You know, they are smaller pieces which are more mental exercises to refine your craft. So I do write a lot of those poetic, but they are more abstract in nature. And they're more for me. I am the audience of that. And they're more of my own personal meditations, I would call them. Mm-hmm. And then all of my work that I try to put out there, I think they are more governed or by what I really want to put out there. And because my background, if I were to talk a little bit about it, it's like it's in theater. I was not someone who actually grew up with poetry. I wanted to write theater. I was a theater actor back in Pakistan. And people who were teaching me, and one of my professors, she is a daughter. She's an educator, an artist, but she's a daughter of one of the most celebrated poets of South Asia. His name is Faiz Ahmed Faiz. And Faiz Ahmed Faiz. He's a very, very fascinating character. I'll talk more about him because he's also connected to like Palestine and Lebanon. Mm. And he won Lenin Peace Prize for a lot of his work. So he was a political figure and a poet as well. So his work has like a really, really a lot of impact on people coming from South Asia and beyond. So his daughter actually was basically, she spotted me and she's like, Faraz, if you really want to learn the craft of writing and if you really want to actually like delve into it deeper and understand how to use words with their full effect, you really need to engage with poetry. You will learn the melody of it. And that's how I was introduced because I felt like a lot of those, because in Pakistan and India, a lot of poetic works written by poets are sung. And yes. Ghazals as a format allows singers and different musicians to actually pick that up. I knew a lot of those poetry then because I've already heard it. And also something that I also do research on, that how poetry kind of takes everyday expressions and the way it actually alters the idiom in the mold of poetry, it somehow, the most effective ones, they become part of people's everyday life. It's very surprising when you're like in Pakistan and you're interacting with people on an everyday basis, and they would quote poetry without even knowing that they won't have any interest in poetry, but they would quote poetry, and as an expression. Like for example, my wife, she says, I have nothing to do with poetry, but whenever she wants to make a point, she uses poetic expressions, which are, yeah.
So I wanted to add, when you were talking about design and poetry together, I'm not a design person at all. And so my poetry is very chaotic, I feel. It comes and, you know, I'll scribble stuff. But when I see yours, I definitely see it as an element of design. Like I see, sometimes I see shapes as well, probably because of the stuff you post. But obviously because you're thinking in a certain way and then you place them in a particular style and manner. So that I want to take that to Zerza Berpesh, because obviously I think there is an educative aspect to of what you do when it comes to poetry, Urdu poetry. So tell us a little bit about that.
So when my journey started, I got in and I started learning about poetry. My first interaction was, and my first impression was like, these are everyday words, but they actually bear a lot more weight than how we use it on day-to-day basis. And I was like, they say that any beautiful poem, it's actually, it enchants you before you understand it. And my first attempt, like just like everyone was like, I'm trying to understand it. Like it's a piece of text. I need to understand it in concrete terms. But luckily I was going to an art school. So I was being taught other modes of art, so I could appreciate that I don't really need to make sense of it in a very reductive in reductive terms. And I got enchanted for life, and I couldn't, you know, like you always see me with the book of poetry, because that exposed me to like this whole new universe. And for me, I love celebrating the idea that how we are able to think about feel and think about these ideas, which actually like are not real, but, you know, they kind of express and they tell so much about us as humans and our human civilization and our culture. And how do we borrow so much from so many different places? So that was my one of the first things that it kind of exploded my mind that, oh, this is a whole different universe that, you know, as a tradition hasn't been passed on to me, but has been around me. And now this is a minefield and I need to just, you know, I can just explore it for. So in that process, somehow I kind of like detached from theater. And I started like going deeper and I started enjoying solitude and I started enjoying. So I used to do theater because I was a people's person. I enjoyed working with people, but poetry made me a more someone, a person who likes to introspect more.
I'm curious, like you've lived in Pakistan, right? Were you born there?
I was born there.
You were born in Pakistan. Then you came and lived in the UAE?
Yeah, in the UAE, in Abu Dhabi, Sharjah, Dubai.
Right. And then you went back and then came for your art school and then came back.
Yeah.
So I speak Urdu, but this realization of actually picking, you know, taking up Urdu as a language where I have to study and understand it in a more deeper level, because the kind of Urdu that I, you know, generally people speak... And even in Pakistan now, it's just your daily vernacular, like they'll, you know, whatever we speak, the slang, but we don't read into it. I think majority of the people know what, I don't know, 10-15% of the vocabulary. I don't think they know more than that. So there's like theater and then poetry. There's where you sort of
But before that, you just mentioned my journey. So there's a very interesting link here. I moved here when I was in grade 4 and then I started learning Arabic. And I learned Arabic until my high school. And again, what happened, because I used to study with a lot of like white kids, and for them, it was more difficult to pick up Arabic, right? So I remember like one of the first few exams, Arabic exams for Arabic, for non-Arab exams, I used to write and everyone was allowed to cheat from my paper.
Yeah, you were that guy.
Yeah, I was that guy. And I was
were
like...
Were they paying you?
Well, they I wish they did. And they were paying me in lunches. So, and I went back to Pakistan. And when I was going to Pakistan, I was a bit scared that, oh, what if someone speaks to me in like really intense, formal Urdu, what I'm going to do? But when I went there, a lot of people that I met on day-to-day basis, because they don't learn Urdu as a language of aspiration, right? They just have, they learn because they really have to. But I started noticing certain things that I was actually trained to see. Like, for example, in Arabic, you're learning with the movement of the vowels, the meaning of words changed, right? It changes all the time. So the kasr, dhamma, and, you know, we call it zair, zabar, and pesh.
Okay.
And so
Fatha, kasra, dhamma. Is
exactly Fatha, kasra. And in Urdu we call it zair, zabar, pesh. And what happened, because it's mostly spoken, it's less written, I would start observing that, did he say mustaqbil or did he say mustaqbal, or did he say muntazir or did he say muntazir? For them, they have lost that sensibility.
I love that.
And I, growing up, like, because I was learning Arabic over here, I was like more sensitive to that. And most of the people learning Urdu, they don't understand that the morphology that they use in Urdu is coming from Arabic. And it all goes to the root word, like qadar, qaf, dal, and ra becomes iqtadar, muqtadar, you know. So similarly, so they are, there's a more Urdu's being spoken phonetically.
What about Farsi though? While you're at it, I'm going to add that.
I think Farsi, I don't have command over Farsi. But like again, Urdu, Farsi,
does it take...
So Urdu takes a lot of features of Farsi. Like, for example, there's a whole construction mode where you take a noun and an adjective and a noun are basically connected together to create an expression. Like Mughal e Azam. So it adds the sound. Like how we have in Arabic, we have Ul. For them, it's a small
connection. Yes. Yeah.
So if you say Mughal ul Azam in Persian, they say Mughal e Azam.
Yeah, Mughal. Right. And that's, we've taken that.
So we have taken that. We use Persian constructions,
right?
And we use a lot of Persian grammatical features, but because, like, for example, there's so much cross pollination that is taking place, and people who are learning or people who are reading, just because they don't, in a way, like, I think it's humanity's crisis overall in the larger region. We have kind of lost some understanding of our recent history. There's cultural, historical amnesia, big time. Like, for example, people have completely forgotten that Arabic was one of the major scientific languages of India. Like, that's why even if you go in India and you go to a courtroom scene and you see, like, they use the word wakil, they use mawakil, they use, like...
I didn't know that. I thought Farsi was the official language.
Well, Farsi actually absorbed, because...
State language.
Yeah, but Farsi absorbed a lot of Arabic as well.
Right, yes, of course.
So, because in Arabic, you have one root word and it creates, like, an entire family of words which is interrelated. So, in terms of a system, a cohesive and comprehensive system, Arabic is a very grand language for sure. So, it is used as part of a legal framework. And in Pakistan, when we say, or India as well, that whose Urdu is better or less is completely based on how much Persian or how much Arabic they can use in their Urdu.
Okay, to fill in the gaps.
Yes, or to have a better and more articulate...
Yes, to express... Yeah, because otherwise you're just doing your daily...
Yeah, so this guy, the Faiz Ahmed Faiz, who you're actually like, we were talking about, he is a massive Urdu poet, right? He's a very popular, like, he's like, he, even Edward Said talked about him.
Yeah.
Like, and he's also in India recently when they were protesting, they were singing songs that were written by him.
Yeah.
So he has like a global audience. He did his, he studied Arabic.
So here I, okay, so this is a nice segue. We want to like get into the ghazal bit now.
Okay.
So you're talking about Arabic as the obviously it, the foundation, and the fact that it was an official language in pre-colonial times, I suppose?
No, even in the colonial era, like when the Britishers were, they had their own legal system, right? And the Muslim aristocrats, they were trying to establish an equivalent language for a judiciary system. They were using Arabic as a model and a language because it was the most refined scientific language. Even now in Pakistan, when people are doing research in Urdu on any scientific matter, they need to use Arabic. They still rely in Pakistan today. If you go to, there are a lot of makatib and there are a lot of places where all the scientific research and a lot of academic research is done in Arabic. There are books published in Arabic.
I actually learned something recent about the Arabic language, and it's that unlike English, I don't know about other languages, and I want to pose this question to you guys about Urdu and maybe Farsi if you guys know, but unlike English, the Arabic language does not have the concept of synonyms. Have you ever heard this thing before? As in, every single Arabic word has something unique about it. Even the words that sound like they are exactly the same, like for example, ata wa ja'a, you ask any regular person, they will think they both mean the same. Ata ja'a means arrived, the person has arrived or come. Yeah. But I learned this concept because I'm reading this author, his name is Muhammad Shahrour, and he has a modern way of interpreting the Quran. And he dedicated his life to interpreting the Quran based on how the Quran used these Arabic words. So for example, he takes these two words, ata wa ja'a, and they are mentioned in the Quran. Sometimes it says ata, and sometimes it says ja'a. And then he's like, wait, let's ask questions. Why is God saying ata here in all these ayat? And why is he saying ja'a in all these ayat? And he deciphers the difference between them. And in this specific example, I learned that the difference is ata means, as in the thing that has arrived, it came from the narrator. Atainakum al-ilm, for example, as in
I gave
you, like, your knowledge has arrived from me. Whereas ja'akum ahl whatever means the thing that has arrived, it came from a third party, not the narrator.
It was given.
Yeah.
From
a third party. As in, like, it's not me where the thing came from. It came from somewhere else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just something I learned recently about the Arabic language. I don't know if you... Do you know anything about this in Urdu? I wonder.
Urdu actually, like, borrows so much vocabulary from different languages at once. So, like, for example, it borrows a lot of vocabulary from Turkish, Arabic, Persian, Sanskrit, and a lot of other, because it's like an... I call it like it's the language of the crossroads, mm-hmm. right? It's basically a language when so many different cultures came together.
Lashkari Zaban.
Yeah, Lashkari Zaban. But I'll tell you something interesting. Even in Dubai, you go to Old Souk, you see an Iranian guy talking to a South Indian guy. Oh. They don't speak each other's language. They are not speaking in English, but they are talking to each other in some kind of broken language which is basically a language that they're trying to, you know, come together.
Meet in the middle.
That's what Urdu is.
No way.
That is Urdu or Hindi, to be very honest.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know that. Okay, that's funny.
And
what's Lashkar in English? Lashkar
is basically like
battalion.
The camp,
right?
the army camp.
Yeah.
What's the story of that?
So basically the Iranian, the Persians who actually came to towards India, they used to have their camps. They used to speak Persian. But to be able to interact with people, people who were actually, like, you know, the locals, they used to use a part of their structure language. They used to use their structure, but they used to use their vocabulary. So in a way, it was Urdu before it was, like, formed, it was actually being used by scholars or poets or writers. It was actually spoken in a very broken manner by groups of people who were part of army or tribes or troops who were moving into different places, because look, like, South Asia is, like, very diverse, very, very diverse. Like, every, like, they say every 100 kilometer, the language and its dialect is changing. The language is changing. And all of these languages, they are, like, kind of related, but they're still different languages.
So that story about the Lashkar, that, like, they call it a Lashkari language, Urdu, is that's where, like, it kind of formed from.
So Urdu, the word itself means, I think it means camp, army camp.
Yeah, I recently learned
army camp but Urdu, like, it's still, like, a recent usage of the language. Before, it was called Rehta, and which was basically, literally means the mixture. And they're actually having, like, a festival or something.
They are,
Yeah, and...
the festival will be over by the time this goes live.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I don't edit that fast.
It's on the 27th and the 28th.
Of January?
January.
Oh, God, that's...
That's your time. That's your time.
You're making my job impossible.
Oh, my God. It's okay. They would have had a free mention. I'm reading a ghazal in English titled In Arabic, and the poet is a Kashmiri American poet, Agha Shahid Ali. A language of loss. I have some business in Arabic. Love letters, a calligraphy pitiless in Arabic. At an exhibit of miniatures, what Kashmiri hairs, each paisley inked into a golden tress. In Arabic. This much fuss about a language I don't know. So one day, perfume from a dress may let you digress in Arabic. When Lorca died, they left the balconies open and saw on the sea his qasidas stitched seamless in Arabic. They ask me to tell them what Shahid means. Listen, listen. It means the beloved in Persian, witness in Arabic. Pretty much like what we were interestingly talking about, the Arabic and the Farsi that Urdu captures, right? But obviously this is in English, but I like that he actually says it means the beloved in Persian, witness in Arabic.
Yeah.
You know? So tell us what a ghazal is for us.
Talking about ghazals, it's a daunting task. Okay, so formally, ghazals are, there are verses, and they are written in meters which are coming from Arabic poetry, Arabic ghazals, and they're very established meters that are usually followed. And in a ghazal, so ghazals are like love poems. So there's a lover and a beloved. And in ghazals, mostly you see a symbol metaphor system, right? There's a universe that is constructed which mimics our real world. And using the metaphor and using the figurative language, we kind of, in a way, talk about our lives or how we see different scenarios, conditions, and generate ideas using that word. Like, for example, you have example of a garden. In garden, there is the beloved. The beloved is the gul, the flower, the rose. And there's a bulbul. Bulbul is the nightingale.
Yeah.
And the nightingale is in love with the beauty of the unattainable beauty of that flower. And there's a tension there between the lover and beloved. But at the same time, this whole world mimics our real world. It is basically mortal, right? It has seasons. The beauty that is basically like the epitome, it's an ideal, right? But it's going to fade. It's going to die when the spring season will go and the winters will arrive. And at the same time, the gul and the bulbul, the nightingale and the flower, the rose, they are threatened. They are threatened by the flower picker. And the bulbul is also threatened by the bird catcher, Sayyad. And he's probably going to catch him and put him in the prison. So this universe actually has characteristics, certain conditions, and the laws, which are very similar to the laws of the world that we live in. Now, using the symbol and metaphor, the poet actually kind of generates ideas, creates a theme, and within the theme, generates more meanings. So every ghazal actually has an underlying theme of lover and beloved, but that beloved can be a person, can be God, or can be your home country.
Yeah.
And so the speaker or the poet or the writer or the protagonist, he's a lover who is struggling, who has struggles, right? And he represents someone from us. And using this universe, so ghazal has many universes like this. Similarly, like there is a tavern. Tavern has the someone who's actually intoxicated in love, right? And there's a drinker, and there's a saki who's pouring the intoxicant into the glass of the, so it is another universe. And then there is the shama and parwana, which is basically like the flame and the moth.
Yeah,
it is also a universe. And then we have a mehfil. So that is called a mehfil, Shama Parwana Mehfil. So ghazal world actually has these very well-established symbol metaphor systems, which are employed to actually like create themes. And with those themes, we actually create more meaning and develop more ideas under where the underlying theme is the lover and beloved.
So universes. I want to come to that, but I want to ask, like, was it always universes, or did it come from like just romantic love first?
So it does come from romantic love.
And did it come like that in Arabic?
Yeah.
So in Arabic it was romantic love.
Yes. So basically from 6th, 7th century, from the Qasida genre, ghazals are coming. But what is a ghazal? You grew up here in Arabic. What does ghazal remind you of?
A deer.
So ghazal is basically a mortal cry of a gazelle. Oh. Now, it's really important to understand what is a gazelle, right? Some people have like a very oversimplified definition of what a ghazal is. I don't know. I find it very misleading, but you can find it in different places that it's quoted that it's about talking to beautiful women. That's what ghazal is.
Yeah, in Arabic we have sayings like she's as beautiful as a gazelle.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. Now, So that makes more sense that if we go back to a gazelle is beautiful, right? It's delicate and it is always basically, and all, just because gazelle is beautiful and a gazelle is a mortal cry of a gazelle who's wounded, right? And it's
who's
beautiful.
Wounded?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's basically, in a way, a lot of poets call themselves gazelle in the desert, in the dasht, basically. And dasht is also a universe,
dasht
right?
Tanhai.
Yeah. So basically, and a ghazal is symbolically of beautiful. That is one ideal. And also gazelle runs fast for her life, basically. And that kind of like represents the vulnerability of a poet possessing so much beauty that you're desirable, but at the same time, you're so vulnerable at the same time.
And so, maybe like eluding, like you cannot catch it.
Yes, it's so elusive.
You're going to write a ghazal very soon. I can see
and,
it.
And like, you know, elusive. And so there's a poet, he actually uses this expression. I'll translate it. He says about himself as a poet, he's saying, Dashte ghazal mein aake dekh, hum to ghazal ho gaye. That he says that come into the universe of a ghazal. By that he's referring to the poetic form of ghazal. Yeah. It's like, come into the universe of a ghazal. Look at me, I have become a gazelle. Like running and escaping from like so elusive in meaning, so elusive in how I use language.
Wow.
And very elusive within my own being. And so it's desirable, but it's also vulnerable. And ghazal also has like tension of ideas. So if you see, they are actually like two lines, right?
Mm.
So there are two lines, and ghazals are often written, but they're also written to be performed. So the way they are written, the first line actually creates a claim, and the second line breaks it.
Hum to ghazal ho gaye.
Yeah. So the ghazal is like kind of like, in a way, creates a lot of tension of ideas. That's why for a reader, it's also like a very, it leaves them restless and they want to keep on thinking
like
about it.
Like when you hear the first verse, you have to listen to the second one. Like, what is it? And that's why often like you see people in mushairas, like, you know, in these settings where, you know, like a spoken word setting, and people be like, oh, wah, wah, wah,
yeah,
wah. You know, like they go, they're like, oh my God. Because usually poets like really like drop a bomb with the second line. But anyways.
So formally, ghazals are like two-line verses, and which is written on a very specific meter. Like now, ghazal world is very sophisticated. It's again coming from Arab world in the 6th century. It actually traveled, and it kind of like, I think around 11th century, reached the Persian world. The Persian world loved it so much, and they explored it. Like all the major Persian poets have actually explored ghazal as a form. And through there, it actually comes to India through this guy called Amir Khusro. He's writing like beautiful poetry in ghazal, where he's writing mostly in Persian and a mix of local, and he's trying to localize it. And then I think in early 17th century, there is this poet called Wali Dakhni. He starts writing ghazals in Urdu, and then became a very popular genre, because people then singing ghazals as a musical form, it has become like that became a very popular form of music, and until now as well. Like, so ghazal singing is a form of singing which is like the most prestigious musical expression in the subcontinent. So any poet who is being sung by any legendary musician becomes immortal. Just like Fairuz and Khalil Gibran and Tom Kulthum, and it's interesting.
So that's the transition of the ghazals, and like how now we, and most people don't, like generally, people don't know what a ghazal is, but they know the ghazal, they've been singing the ghazal.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So for example, so there's only one part which is left, the form.
Yes.
So the ghazal, there are like five features. One is basically they're written in like as a line of two in 1 meter, and the meter has to be followed. Now there is basically the last word of every line, second line of the ghazal needs to be repeated as an alliteration.
Radif?
Yeah.
Yes.
And so they're called radif and kafiya. They need to, and every ghazal actually creates a mold. So if we call it like, it creates a field. We call it zameen. And it creates a mold, and each sher, each verse actually is an independent thought. Minimum, you are supposed to have an odd number of series. So you can have 5, 7, 9, 13.
Why odd?
Just, I think they're trying to kind of like create a harmony between, because it is an even number, right? And so maybe it allows to actually, I personally have read like disputing views. They say that if you're writing a ghazal with the intention of a ghazal, even one verse is a ghazal as well. But some say that, oh, it has to be minimum five, or because it's a very big tradition, right? Spread from Turkey all the way to India. So there is obviously a lot of disputing schools and ideas which are disputed among different
thoughts about
Which is the beauty of it. I love it. Like, I've actually explored so many different areas. I personally don't try to like stick to one. I like to explore more. And so there's that. And so the first line is called a matla. Matla is basically, it's beautiful. I asked, because I interact with a lot of young people in the community, a few days ago, I asked this young guy who's like, in a way, like training with me. I told him that the first verse of a ghazal is called a matla. Can you go and look up in Arabic etymology of this word matla? What does it actually mean?
Let's ask Jamil.
The Arabic speaker.
What does matla mean?
Matla?
Yeah.
I don't know, to be honest, but like, can you spell it out for me?
Yeah, it's basically related to tulu, you know? The point where the sun rises from.
Matlaq.
Matlaq, yes.
Matlaq, yeah, okay, that makes sense to me.
Yeah,
okay.
So basically matla is like a, I think it's just maybe the Persianized way of saying that, or it's a form of the same word. But matla, basically the root word is the point where the sun arises from.
Yeah, I would have defined it as like the place where the thing is somewhat launched from.
Yes, yes.
Wow. Matlaq.
Yeah. And
from itlaq.
Exactly,
like
itlaq.
To,
yeah.
Like shoot or to.
Exactly. Yeah, so, and the last one is called maqta. Maqta is basically like the qata, like that's where it breaks, basically.
Okay.
And so the last verse actually is a lot of the times the poet uses his pen name, which is called a takhallus, and uses his pen name as part of the poem. And that's why, like, a lot of the time the name of the poet or the pen name that the person is using is usually an adjective, so that it's easily used in as
his
part
own
of the
ghazal.
Yeah, like, so and that's why in this poem, yeah, so that's why this is a ghazal that we were talking about earlier, that he uses his name in the last verse, and because that's the tradition that poet always marks his poem. And if any ghazal which becomes popular, because the whole ghazal tradition was an oral tradition, any ghazal poet will become master by performing more and more, but his goal is to become an institution and get different students, and then there's like a whole generation of students who will train under them. And how he will train them, he would give him like one line with the poetic meter and a thought, and then he will ask his students to kind of add their thought to it. So even if you go now on Instagram, it's a recurring tradition. Like, there are Instagram pages that I came across. They're beautiful. They where a person will leave one line and people will kind of respond to it. It works as
beautiful.
A
beautiful.
So this tradition, where did it start from? Like, obviously now we are in this Instagram world and it's that version that we see in today's life.
Modernized version.
Yeah. Thing that you're saying is, like, now the relationship's changed from a poet, but it's from a teacher to a student.
Yeah. That's why most of the knowledge is, in a way, is lost, because previously a lot of that information used to be translated or passed on from an ustad to a shagird, from a master to a student, right? And it was a tradition that they used to call that it's a tradition that has gone sina ba sina, like by from heart to heart. And there are very, very particular peculiarities. Like, for example, this universe thing that I was telling you about, like, it actually, if you go out and if you start looking for books, you won't find it described in this way. And there are people who actually recently they started like theorizing this. And like now people like me are like trying to like, you know, so I made the, what I was explaining you, I'm in the process of coming up with like a card game kind of thing for people to learn poetry with the help of.
That's so cool. Okay.
So this is like the Ghazal universe where I'm trying to say that there's the Gul and the Bulbul, right? And then there are these characters and there are these forces which are kind of like, you know, influencing this universe.
Wow.
And then you read, you can read poetry and you can look at this graphic, infographic, and you're like, oh, it all makes sense to me. I have friends who studied poetry in school their entire life. They never understood it because they were not learning it from a theoretical point. And I think one thing that I would like to add here is like, which is the reason why we are also talking about and why I'm so fascinated by Ghazal. It's like when I was exploring poetry and when I learned that it's art and science at the same time, there is an artistic aspect to it, but poetry in particular is a science. It's an ilm form of, it's not just fun, it's also ilm. This means that it has its own, it is like the poetry has been theorized all the way from people like Jurjani, who actually like theorized classical Arabic poetry. There is a massive, so it's not just the tradition of poets. Along with the tradition of poets, balagha and bayan, they are like two key aspects of
what's
like
balagha, how, please tell me.
It's rhetoric and what's a better word of elucidation, basically.
Okay.
And rhetoric, they are like two key.
So balagha and bayan. Can you just explain this concept? Because I think people need to know.
Yeah. So I'm actually talking to quite a few young scholars. They are trying to come up with like, you know, the most cutting edge theory of how to actually, when people are reading poetry, what are they actually reading in it? The thing is, what the most cutting edge theory that I actually like, I'm trying to like understand more from these students from in academia. What we are trying, when we are reading someone's poetry, we are trying to understand the bayan, what that poet is actually trying to articulate.
Yeah.
Right. We speak in everyday language, but why do we really need poetry? Because we're trying to actually communicate a lot more than what these words can do. So,
yeah, like for example, if I'm sad, I'm like really, really sad, and I write and I just tell you, I feel really sad. You're not going to comprehend how sad I am.
Yeah.
But if I write a poem that like encapsulates how truly sad I am, you'll feel it more. You will get sad reading my sad poem. But if I just tell you I'm sad, you might get a little bit.
Exactly. Sad. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the beauty, that how do we actually like go so deep with the help of words, like these words which actually in everyday life, we, you know, they're called betrayers. They betray us all the time. They betray our heart. They say that there are like two tongues. There's a tongue of the heart and there's a tongue which is in our mouth. And they both don't go hand in hand at all. This is basically the world, the language that we have been conditioned to. But we never speak, unable to speak the heart.
I would
quote a poem of a ghazal, a shayr of a ghazal here. It goes like, Ishq, dil mein rahe to ruswa ho, lab pe aaye to raaz ho jaye. That ishq, love, is notorious if it just stays in the heart. It's such a horrible feeling, right? Why would you actually like,
and
you
a
know,
shame, I suppose. Yeah, like it's just in there.
Yeah. And it's what a shame. Like, you know, it's just nobody knows about it. But the more you try to talk about it, the bigger secret it becomes. The more it gets veiled, the more you talk about it, the utterances, put them behind the veils. The more you talk about it.
By the way, I told my mom this chair, and she was like, "Ye tolta hai." So it's like, it's the opposite. Yeah. It should be the opposite.
Yeah.
And I was like, I couldn't exactly explain to her, but now the way when you explain it,
I
get it.
Yeah.
Did you get it, Jamil?
Not fully. So I understood this, like the passion or the love that you have in your heart. What a shame to keep it in there.
Yeah.
And but once you speak it, it becomes a bigger secret.
Yeah.
How?
Because
is it rumors?
No, because you're unable to express it.
Okay,
because
you
can never.
Yes, it can never. You can never do justice, and the more you actually talk about it,
the more it's losing its flavor and it's losing its authenticity in like the feeling you have inside. And people might be like confused of what you are actually
exactly
saying.
Exactly. Like, you know how when in a very intense moment, in a very passionate moment with your lover, you know, you when you try so hard to actually, like, the more you talk about it, you know, the more you feel like, oh, it's less valued because
I suppose,
it's
yeah.
just, it's, and I think it's also, so that's the nature in ghazals, that they are very profound and
beautiful.
It needs to be celebrated, you know, the complexity and how, because in maybe in real world, contradictions or paradoxes, like, they make no sense.
So,
but in poetry,
yeah. Mm.
Contradictions
is what me and Ghazal, beautiful. I think is all about contradictions.
Yeah, it creates that tension.
Yeah,
the tension between two ideas.
So we're all poets, and then, like, you know, a verse like this, and if I drop it somewhere else to, like, my friends who are not poets, they would be like, deep, like, that's their comment to it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
okay.
It's like, okay, it's, yeah. I think it's, that word deep also means it's sort of out of my reach, like, whatever, you know?
Yeah, it's like, well, I'm like, not you. Like, I'm not used to having conversations at that level
yeah.
of, like, introspection.
Yeah, introspection.
To, like, I'm used
yeah.
to, like, conversations in a more, like, shallow level in a world of, like, this way. And so when maybe someone says something like that, it's like, oh, whoa, you're taking me somewhere new.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Introspection is nice. Ghazal is introspection,
exactly.
I suppose, isn't it?
Introspection. And there's one thing which I actually, like, we were talking about Bayan and Balagha, and there is, like, one scholar that I would like to, like, quote and also encourage everyone, people who are, like, into Arabic poetry, because she's actually, like, a scholar of classical Arabic poetry. Her name is Lara Herb, and she basically talks about aesthetics of wonderment and how basically, like, post-revelation of Quran, how basically, like, how language and literature and poetry is actually was being created, and how those systems and how those theories were basically, like, trying to talk about the pleasure that we receive in discovery of meanings. And poetry became the whole, like, for example, there is this verse in, like, when I say actually that, you know, I'm interested in ideas which are deeply rooted in Quran, it kind of also, some people also get confused. So you are interested in poetry because you want to understand Quran? I'm like, yeah, because I see, like, there's a very beautiful connection. And because it requires imagination. So there's of Surah Ar-Rahman, there's I think the 17th verse where God says, Rabbul Mashriqaini wa Rabbul Maghribain. Like, I'm the Lord of two Easts and two Wests. And for me, this is most fascinating because, you know, when you look at it literally, anyone who's just reading this should make no sense. Two East and two West. I'm the Lord of two East and two West. Why should this make any sense? Unless you actually, like, now this is the question, this is the concern with wonderment. Even Quran expects the reader to actually meditate on the ideas that are present there, right? It is basically you're reading, but you're also thinking. And if you just look at this, I use it as an example for myself or to talk about the poetry and a certain way of thinking, that I'm here in this hemisphere, let's say,
mm-hmm.
and Eastern Hemisphere, and my left is West, this is East, and let's say now you are in the Western Hemisphere, right, opposite of me. Now, what's your left and what's your right? Your left is East, or your left is your left is West.
The wrong person.
Yeah. So your left.
Her left is West in her perspective.
Exactly. So this means across two hemispheres, I have to imagine myself out of my body in her place to understand if on this earth, God is saying in this verse that he's my Lord and loyal Lord as well, even if we are in the poles apart, very different parts of the world. So,
to quote Nemal's friends, deep.
So that's how basically, like, it creates Maghribain and Mashriqain.
Oh, Maghribain and Mashriqain.
And so there's always basically, like, so
perspective.
It says her work basically, like, briefly talks about that the meaning, that when people were writing poetry, they were using similes and they were using metaphors in a way, and they were programming those ideas and putting them together as riddles that someone who's going to read it, make an effort, and then there will be a moment of discovery, and a revelation, right. And that will evoke wonder and pleasure.
Right.
Someone says that we don't take our pleasure seriously. That's why we don't really enjoy or celebrate the pleasure of thinking. And that is also one of my agendas and my reasons to actually promote ghazals, because I don't actually tell people that people need to write ghazals. I say that ghazal needs to be studied as an institution, because look at them. They are like coming from the 6th century. They're geographically very widespread. This means it has actually captured ideas from so many traditions, so many culture. And also the mold of it, the form of it is so challenging for the mind that it actually allows you to do contemplative hiking. It allows you to do mental heavy lifting. Right. So I know people, I have friends, I know people that actually learn from ghazals, but they're doing other things in life. And it also, it helps. Why not, you know, enjoy reading? Why not enjoy thinking?
And just imagine the amount of hidden treasures of meanings that are still hidden in all these ghazals available in the world at the moment.
Yeah.
I love the idea of like a hidden meaning in these poems that like nobody has yet to discover, which is also like a lot about, you know, you're talking about the Quran and you're touching on the Quran and stuff. This is like, you know, if you're a Muslim, you believe that the Quran has this miracle about it, that it's the best poetry ever written.
Yeah.
And that is what the Quran is. It's like hidden meanings in every surah and every ayah, which is why, you know, if you believe in the Quran, it mentions that this book is for all times. So there are things that we have yet to discover that the book is trying to tell us, because we have not reached that level of understanding in the world.
Yeah.
And we will reach it in the future. And we will and we will then discover it in the book. You know, the book is not a scientific book where we're going to read the Quran and learn things about science. The book is just a hinting to these things that we will discover in the world. And then later on, read the book again and be like, oh my God, it's been telling us. It's like, there it is. There's the meaning in that ayah.
Yeah. There's a book called Ajaib al-Makhlukat, which is basically like wonders of creation.
The wonders of, Makhlukat.
Yeah. And basically that book actually says that everything that has been designed to evoke wonder. It's just, we get used to those. That's what wonder is. Like, even that's what we're trying to do in poetry as well. Right? That when someone is reading poetry, they are actually discovering something which is hidden. It's not something which is never there. It's basically, it's something which was hidden. And the pleasure of, you know, when we are at work, you know, we are trying to, like, we all are creative people. When we are trying to, like, you know, make an effort, and the moment we have an idea, or when we are writing poetry, you know, we get ideas to build on that idea.
And I'm like in the middle of meeting and I'm like, oh my God, that was really good. And I start, like, people think I'm jotting down minutes maybe, but I'm actually writing a poem down quickly.
That happens to me in the middle of the night. I'm just waking up, and because my brain is like working very stimulated, and just start.
That's the wonder.
Yeah. So that's what I like. Ghazal is my passion, but I don't like, the whole idea is to encourage people to think with the help of poetry. And I try to do this without any biases. Also try to, with a lot of humility.
What do you mean by that?
By that is like when you go out and you take any field, any practice, or you join any community, people have biases for people who are different or might not understand anything. When I was learning a lot of these things, I was coming across people who belong from certain schools, or they would be like, oh, you know, they would talk, they make things political, and someone would look down that, oh, this kid doesn't even know this. Like, how would they know? Like, they're not supposed to know, because they are going to British schools. Like, they are not actually learning about, they're learning about Keats and Byron. They're not learning about, like, your own, like, they're not learning about Mahmud Darwish or Khalil Gibran or Ghalib you know, Fez. So, because if it's about us, people, and understanding, I'm not chasing one tradition. I believe in human tradition. And I see, and what Urdu literature actually is like has taught me as well, that it's, you know, you need to create crossroads. And everything is like inspiring each other. Like I showed this video to a friend of mine. She's a Pakistani girl. She got married to an Egyptian guy. And she's like, I don't know. I feel so. I'm like, you know, who is like your boyfriend must have told you about Umm Kulthum. Was like a massive, superstar. Yeah. He's listening to her all the time. I'm like, do you know that Umm Kulthum, she actually sang a song, a poem written by a Pakistani poet called Muhammad Iqbal. And she's like, no.
Because he wrote in Arabic?
No, he wrote it. He wrote it, Shikwa, the complaint.
Oh, yeah.
And it became such a popular poem in the Muslim world that it got translated into 30 languages, and Umm Kulthum, like, she performed that song. It's on YouTube.
Let's tell Jameel about what Shikwa is. It's beautiful, the concept, isn't it?
Let's play the Umm Kulthum song. I'll play the
Umm Kulthum song.
Umm Kulthum song break.
تدركه القلوب بلا عناء هتفت به فطار بلا جناح وشق أنينه صدر الفضاء ومعدنه ترابي ولكن جرت في لفظه لغة السماء لقد فاضت دموع العشق مني حديثا كان علويا لدائي فحلق في ربى الأفلاك حتى أهاج العالم الأعلام
The shikwa is complain. Yeah. It's complaining to God.
Shakwa, yeah.
Right? Or complaining with God.
Complaining to God.
To God.
Complaining to God, yeah.
And then there is a poem that he wrote because people were like, how could you complain to God?
So poem, the poet, actually, he's like one of the towering Muslim figures in coming from South Asia. And
he's the nation's poet.
Pakistan. Nation's poet, but also, like, I think he's a bigger figure than that.
Of course he is, yeah.
And he actually, like, he's a major poet. And he is also a politician because it was the need of the time because it was India and Pakistan were under the British colony at that time.
His name again, sorry?
Muhammad Iqbal.
Muhammad Iqbal, yes, okay.
Yeah. And again, he was writing about, and he was basically like someone who's like, studying and want to kind of like understand that why the Muslims actually in the world are declining and why and the poem this one which became really popular because it kind of in a way was something that was in hearts and minds of all the other Muslims basically in the part of the world which were like kind of declining, losing their authority or losing their heritage or connections with their heritage. So the poem kind of like talks about that, you know, like you, we were the people, and he talks about entire Muslim lineage, that we did this for you, we did this for you, you, like, you know, and we don't get this, and all of your perks are for the people in the West, and, you know, and look at all the way, like, you know, to, like, we build the Cordoba mosque for you, we did this, we did, he makes all the, and then, when he actually, in 1911, he performed this poem as a part of a very massive protest, or no, it's not a protest, a jalsa. What would be a jalsa?
Julus is a rally.
Yeah, a rally kind of thing. Yeah, okay. So a political rally.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
And and then people say that, you know, like, and but he was inspired by a lot of like Arabic poets and German poets, and he was inspired by both Eastern and Western.
So people
poets.
Came back at him.
So yeah, he actually was using a lot of like Hegelian methods to actually write and devise poetry. So. He was doing dialectical thinking, that he would present one idea, right? And then he would present another idea which will complete both of the ideas. So he wrote response to that complaint in 1914, 3 years later. Yeah.
As in a response to people calling him out on his complaints?
Yeah, on yeah. On the first poem, Shikwa. So yeah. He wrote then Jawab-e Shikwa, which is the answer to the answer to the complaint?
Yeah, answer to the complaint. And that is by God.
Okay, so his poem is like speaking from God's perspective to him.
This is a very memorable poem for me because also like poetry became part of my journey and allowed me to question a lot. So this is the poem I got into trouble for. In 2011, this was the time when I was basically transitioning from...
It's 100 years after he performed it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay. I had never thought of it. Let's in 2011, it. I'm in Lahore and there's this very prestigious place called Alhamra. And I was directing an act over there where we were supposed to perform Shikwa and Jawab-e Shikwa. So I was training with my troupe and someone told me that, oh, Faraz, we have the person who's going to perform the complaint. You have, you know, masculine, deep voice. Why don't you do the voice of God as a Jawab-e Shikwa? And I was like, but why do you think that God is a guy with a deep voice.
Oh, Whoops.
And I was like, you know, the God I know or my parents taught me about or the one I know, like tells, like, I know that God loves me more than my mother or, you know, like all the references of God that I know are like as womanly, as manly, right? So we're like, okay, let's basically like, you know, break this stereotype and let's just, why can't, the response of God can be performed by a woman. So we trained a woman, we performed, and some of the people, they really lost their shit.
In the audience?
Yeah.
What did they do?
They got up, they're like, this is bullshit, like how you can actually perform Jawab, a woman can perform Jawab. And you know what was more daunting? The thing is, for the person performing Jawab, Shikwa, complain, they could see the performer. But the Jawab-e Shikwa, the complaint, the response of the complaint was coming from an unknown source,
backstage.
Right? Backstage. So they could not see the woman, that oh woman, right? God.
So and people are losing their shit and the thing is continuing.
Yeah, that thing is continuing. Now, the reason why this thing is continuing, because we pre-recorded her part.
Okay.
She was not performing live, right? And people are getting up, they're like making this noise, and the poem is going.
Whoa.
And at one point, the organizer had to stop, and like they told us, like, you know, these people are going to get really pissed off, so it's better you guys leave as a troupe right now.
This is in university?
This was not in my university. When I was studying in university, but I was in another place.
Okay.
And in Lahore. It's a arts and cultural center. And so, yeah, they kind of like, we got quite a few threats for this. But that was the first time it really shook me to the core that, you know, I understood that how deep patriarchal roots are, that, oh, I never thought that God is a guy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, to also...
How dare you question that?
But, you know, we all say that there is no gender, but obviously could be closer to this, not the female version, the voice or whatever, and how it hurts people.
Yeah, the point is how it hurts people.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
And
yeah.
And there, that's why when you look at it, there's like a lot of criticism as well. Like, you will find most of the Urdu poets or ghazal writers they're male. They're very like, in comparison to men, very few female poets were like celebrated.
Right.
And
yeah,
and
true.
There's like this whole, but at the same time, ghazal has like, beloved can have any gender. So that's why even like, it's basically like a very fluid. Like, very fluid in that sense.
Much like even our current day and age. Gender is a fluid concept.
Well, ghazal itself sounds a very feminine thing to me. Right. I don't know if that's a... I don't know what reaction you have, but like because of the name ghazal itself, like the word
I have
ghazal.
Met both men and women called
oh,
ghazal.
Oh, have you?
So, yeah.
Ghazal?
Yeah.
Ghazaluddin sahab.
Yeah. No. Ghazal was enough.
Okay.
Yes.
I am with you. This ghazal, I think what you are trying also to do maybe with your passion and what you're doing in your life, even with this infographic that you created. Mm. You created that infographic. Do you mind if we post it, by the way?
Sure.
Just to say for the listeners, like if you want to look at the infographic, you just check the Instagram. And I'm with you. Like we need to celebrate ghazal more, teach more people about ghazal, discover its like secrets that are hidden within all these ghazal poems. How do we go about doing that? How do you go about achieving that mission?
I'm doing two things. One is basically I'm trying to use the platform to actually kind of create comfort for a lot of young writers. I have always focused on younger poets because I'm like, I can never, as a designer, I know that you have to work with certain type of audience. And I see my audience as ambassadors. And ambassadors of like certain ideas. And those ideas are that I'm trying to put forward to them. That as a poet, if you're a young person, you need to learn your art and as a science as well. So what I do in my platform, I try to break it down and I kind of encourage people to think about it. And I use cues from academia. I use academic papers. I use a lot of, like, for example, I would teach them about poetic devices. So, like, it's beautiful because it actually, like, I've met people that, like, you know, who use these on daily basis. And when they're writing, they start identifying that, oh, I didn't know that I used this device. Mm. So I'm in a way, like, curating.
Yeah, showing the tools.
Yes.
In order to decipher and in order to write.
Exactly. And then what I do is also I do these poetry gatherings in the park and wherever I travel. I did my first one at Hyde Park. I was not expecting a lot of people to come because, again, it's like, I don't know. It's not a dying art, but it's like there's a revitalization that is required, which is happening right now. Right. I just, you know, sent a post, put it up on my platform, which I don't kind of run with a lot of like planning. I just
shout out the platform. What is it called?
It's called Zerzaberpesh.
Zerzaberpesh.com
on Instagram.
Oh, and at Instagram. Okay, we'll put the link in the description for sure.
And what happens is like, so when I sent out an invitation, like a call that, you know, we're gathering and we're discussing this poet in a park. So I made a format. I take the poet and the park location. And for example, Mirza Ghalib at Hyde Park. Allama Iqbal at Ferrer Hall Park. So and what I do is I invite people. So in the first one, I just didn't realize 70 people showed up.
70?
70.
Yo, that's a huge number.
That's a good turnout.
And they were like literally from a 5-year-old to someone who was like in late 60s. And my skill that I've kind of developed over the years, because I really empathize with people who are trying to learn, that I'm trying to engage everyone.
Yeah.
I don't care about that one person who has a superior reading. Okay, good for you. But again, we all are here to learn. And I believe in cross-pollination. Never think that anyone's reading is of lesser value. As anyone who thinks or cares about people and also smart enough to understand that all of us are on a journey and there's no competition. And that's what I also liked about ghazal and poetry in general, that it kind of like, you know, makes us uncomfortable enough to question our own biases and misguided desires, because we are conditioned and trained to oversimplify things. We need to find ways to put someone or something in a box, but why? And I think poetry really challenges that. It doesn't allow you to actually, you cannot be a poet and putting people in a box.
In boxes, yeah.
I had, so, you know, we, Faraz and I, recorded a poem. And I read it out, and I had an iPad in my hand. So just from the conversation about the boxes, people don't let anything go. So I was holding the iPad and reading from there. And people started commenting about, you know, like Urdu literature, poetry, all of this, at least pick up a book. You know, make it look authentic. But then you're immediately limiting anyone who has access to,
that's,
you know,
the thing.
Simple
it's,
stuff.
It's restrictive.
Yeah, it's with poetry as well, especially like in South Asia, it happens a lot that if you're a poet, that you need to carry yourself a certain way.
Right.
Yeah. I really challenged that. And I remember someone actually insulted me on Instagram like a few years ago. I was performing and I was like in my leather jacket and stuff because I was like, whatever I like to wear, I'm going to perform poetry because it has to do with ideas, not what I am. So it has to be compatible with my life, or like, and why it can't be compatible because I'm not performing. So someone wrote a massive like post about me calling me that I think that I'm the Kanye West of Urdu literature.
Oh my God, I love this.
Yeah, the person was trying to insult me and
I'll take it as a compliment.
Yeah, like the thing is, and it worked. People liked it. People reposted it and it
the Kanye West, oh my God.
And at these gatherings, I actually like try to turn people into ambassadors. So the one I did in London at Hyde Park, I told them that this is how you're supposed to conduct it, right? Be humble, kind to people. And I took two girls over there and I asked them, now you have the community, people who are interested. You have my platform where I break down information, pick any of the posts, come here next month and continue. So that group has grown. Like they're like, it's like more than 200 people.
It's actually really amazing.
You just like went there, planted a seed and just left and now it's growing.
And I am, through my platform, I'm continuously talking to younger poets. I'm working on smaller projects. Honestly, it's very easy to talk about like, you know, lofty things and lofty ideas. But I really enjoy the process of learning through activity, like for example, even meeting Namal, talking to her about poetry, or even like, you know, having a conversation with you. I enjoy, and I think there's so much that you can learn about art and poetry from people, not just books. And
yes. True. Amazing. Yeah, I'm a firm believer of community as well when it comes to these things. So I want to, I read a ghazal in English. So we kind of like skipped to the English ghazal. We actually didn't read the Urdu ghazal that we've been talking about. Again, part of what you're saying now, I mean, ghazals have now traveled from Arabic to Farsi to Urdu to English. And English has its own rules as well. We're not very strict with English ghazals. What are your thoughts? What do you think about this Urdu ghazal traveling from the languages in Asia to the Western world?
It's beautiful. I think it's amazing. It's like, I really admire people that were actually, because it's less about, okay, the language has its own smell and it, but what about those people who are actually not born into that language? But at the same time, if ghazal as a sentiment, as a mode, or the way it kind of works, its own history, its own tradition, and the lineage and the lineage of ideas that it actually creates, and the practice of formulating ideas, that can happen in any language. I still think it's a lot better than translating something from. And I think it's beautiful that in, let's say, in 60s, 70s, when a lot of these people who wanted to do modernist writings, a lot of modern literature from Europe and the US actually came towards the Arab world and also the South Asia, and it kept on. And now that, you know, it's and just because a lot of people from, let's say, I'm going to talk about South Asia in particular, they moved to Europe, they moved to the US, their first generation moved there, they struggled. Now the younger generation, newer generation, they have less to prove, right? So now they're getting more comfortable with getting to know their roots. And it's beautiful that people are exploring and we are creating, you know, these crossroads, and we're creating new culture, which still has its roots, you know, what needs to be carried forward, the fruit actually, you know, that the pollination is still happening.
I think that's the beautiful thing about it, is that we're able to write. So from, my first ghazal was in English. There, I mean, I have not even attempted writing a ghazal because I don't have the vocabulary, enough vocabulary to write a ghazal in Urdu. But what is important with what you've said, so doing these, having this platform, being more informative about ghazals and poetry, having these get-togethers, these gatherings. So whether I write, like for me, writing the ghazal in English actually pushed me to study the Urdu ghazal more, because it is part of our lives. We've been singing songs. A lot of them are ghazals. People whose language is whose first language isn't even Arabic and English, they're also writing English ghazals.
Like, identity is something which is like, I feel that it's partly you don't choose, and partly is like you kind of make conscious decisions and to actually like create that part of, or cultivate that part of your identity. But then there are a lot of people who actually, like, if you are born here, it's like your parents decided to move here, right? So it's like, the thing is, then whatever that is, what you know and what you don't know is also part of your story. And I don't think so there's any like need to be like holding back how people like to express. I still believe that people who are exploring the arts, they still need to learn the canon, to break the canon, or to respond. I don't think people can break canon. They can respond to canon, and they can create, modify, and create their own canons. Because without learning about the canons, you cannot even access your own self. I think like it's just, those are the reasons why we learn. We are not learning canons to conform to something.
Yeah,
we're learning canons because they are there to kind of educate us about, inform us about. That's why when I say that when people read poetry, they are not stepping down into the mind of the poet. You can never do that. You are stepping down into your own mind.
Ooh, I like that.
It's basically, so whatever discovery is yours, the pleasure is yours, and you need to take that discovery and pleasure quite seriously.
I also want to consider that as a defense for a poet. You will never know me, no matter how much poetry you read about me, written by me.
Well, I guess I would add a little note to that. I would say something like, we are all going through the human experience.
Yeah.
And I'm just making your human experience somewhat closer to my human experience. You know, at the end of the day, what I'm writing and what you're reading from my writings, it's going to make you feel a certain way that I felt.
Yes.
Yeah. And I wrote this poem. I don't have it on me right now, but it's titled Transcendence, basically. And it's basically talks about, once you write your work and you put it on paper, it grows beyond you. Yeah. It's not just yours anymore. And that's what happened. Sometimes it even becomes bigger than you.
Which is why we don't let go of a lot of the personal work.
Because you universalize it. When you universalize it, then it belongs to
The universe. It's not yours anymore. Right? Yeah, true.
So it's also, and the more universal it is, the longer it lives. So this is a ghazal by Mirza Ghalib. Daim pada hua tere dar par nahi hu main, khaak aisi zindagi pe ke patthar nahi hu main. Kyun gardish mudam se ghabra na jaye dil, insaan hu pyala o sagar nahi hu main. Ya rab zamana mujhko mitata hai kis liye, lohe jahan pe harfe muqarrar nahi hu main. हद चाहिए सजा में उकूबत के वास्ते, आखिर गुनहगार हूं काफिर नहीं हूं मैं. किस वास्ते अजीज नहीं जानते मुझे, लालो जमर्रुदो जरो गौहर नहीं हूं मैं. रखते हो तुम कदम मेरी आंखों से क्यों दरेग, रुतबे में महरो माह से कमतर नहीं हूं मैं. करते हो मुझको मनाए कदम बोस किस लिए, क्या आसमान के भी बराबर नहीं हूं मैं. गालिब वजीफा खार हो दो शाह को दुआ, वो दिन गए के कहते थे नौकर नहीं हूं मैं. Now Now, that's something which is interesting with ghazals, that ghazals were written in meter. This means you, if you're going to read it once or twice, you're never going to forget it because of the melody.
Yeah.
And the more universal it is, the more pleasure it is, the more everyday life-like it is, the more chances that it will live. So Ghalib, Mir, Iqbal, people who actually wrote stuff hundreds of years ago are still are used in the people's conversation every day. So that's why, you know, canons and those kind of things. Ghazal, that's why I think lived longer than so many other formats, because it's also very, it's modular, it's smaller, right? It's like haikus, right? You can not
true. Actually, yeah. It's lots of haikus. Yeah.
And Ghazal also has this whole feature of the economy of effort. Like, you have to kind of pack so many meanings and ideas within one.
Within a tiny pocket.
Yeah. And in ghazal, why I have one feature that I like the most, I think it allows me to, like, summarize why I think it's so interesting and so, that makes it, like, so fruitful for, like, to even, like, to read with people, is that when ghazal actually came from the Persian world to India, because the languages were like, there were so many languages that were being spoken in close proximity. That's what I understand, that each word can actually imply multiple things, like how you were talking about
synonyms
in Arabic. So, like, for example, there are a lot of words in, like, say, which are spoken in South Asian contexts. Based on how they are used, they can change. Like, for example, we have this word called kya. Kya means what? But how you say it, kya, kya, kya. So what happens in India in particular, because of so many languages coming together and the cosmopolitan culture, people were doing theme creation as one of the basic pursuits of poetry. But within that theme, they started creating meanings. So one verse can actually can have five different interpretations. And there's a word which is in it's in Arabic, but in literary, it's in the literary usage of it, it's very specific. It's called iham. Iham means, a lot of people translate it as ambiguity. Iham is a quality of a ghazal poet. That iham means vehem mein dalna. You put you confuse people, that it doesn't mean this or does it mean this. So it can mean multiple things.
The elusiveness.
Yeah, it can have, it can be a word, can be multidimensional. So you take this dimension, it opens a different meaning. If you take this dimension, it takes a different meaning. So what would happen, there will be one verse, two lines can give you like around 10 interpretations.
Yeah.
And the poet started doing that consciously, that the bigger, the greater the poet, the more they were trying to pack more meaning into it.
Right, like different meanings that could be interpreted.
Was it Fez Ahmed Fez?
No, that was Ghalib, Mir. Fez was doing that as well. Iqbal was doing that. But that is something which is like a very key feature of ghazal in South Asia. And now, just because the ghazal is going from South Asia to the Western world, this the multilingual and the multi-meaning is basically going from this part of the world to
it's like reading that book. I don't know if you used to read them when you were younger. You would like get to like page 3 and it would say, if you want to open the door, go to page 5.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you want to like check under the bed, go to page 50.
Exactly. Exactly.
But just to correct a small, tiny misconception, it's not exactly the concept of what I had mentioned, because what I had mentioned before about the Arabic language is there's no Arabic word that has a synonym.
Synonym. Okay.
However, in the Arabic language, yes, one word could be interpreted in different
ways.
It's just like there isn't another word that will mean
exactly the same thing. Like, for example, like a lion, based on what the situation is, like Asad, Haider, Abbas, they all are lions, right, with different different adjectives attached to them.
Yeah,
like that's what you meant.
Oh yeah, exactly. That's a great example. Like, I could use the word Asad to describe a lion, like I saw a lion. Or I could say, "Anta Asad," that would mean like you're so mighty.
Yeah.
But there's no other word that can replace the word Asad with its exact same
connotation. Yeah. So that's why I think, you know, when I sit with people and I tell them, because they come with this idea, who are not everyday poetry readers, they would be like, there should be only one meaning. And the idea is also that we have traditionally, culturally, it's a cultural amnesia that when people were performing poetry in Mushaira, the reason why they were actually creating this, like, you know, orgasmic moments for the listeners, because they were like, they will express one interpretation and then they would read it with a slight inflection and they will open another meaning.
Hmm.
They will perform another with a very other inflection, but like they would question, you know, an expression will be with a question.
Yeah.
And there will be another expression with wonder. There will be another question with as a statement. And all of those will be like, and the person will be, the listener is like, wow. Like, this is just, you know...
a roller coaster.
Yeah, like, it's just...
a roller coaster in my mind.
So that was a qualification of a poet. The greater the imagination and what the economy of the effort of words basically like the magic of ghazal. And I see ghazal and the practice of writing ghazal or learning about ghazal is something... I feel, in my opinion, it's a very superior craft to learn from. And then you do... whether you are a painter or a musician, or there's so much you can learn from a very comprehensive, and like if you are a painter, you are actually making symbols, you are using the visual language in a very similar way, you're trying to create unity, harmony. If you're an architect, right, that's what you're trying to do, you're trying to create meaning. And because even now when I work with a lot of architects, I ask them that when you're trying to put together these shapes and these to create these space, what feeling are you trying to evoke?
Right.
They don't know, because it's not something that we learn about.
Or we're and thinking about.
I love that. I think like everybody should learn poetry.
It's as I said earlier, you know, like someone said that it's Umul Funun, like it's the mother of all art.
Yeah. To think before you do something, there has to be poetry in it.
I guess this is we're getting to the end of the conversation, and I just wanted to bring it back to something that you were mentioning at the beginning, which is that, you know, people who don't even know about ghazal or a lot of poetry, yet in their everyday life, they kind of like throw a poem here or there to tell you about like a little lesson that you should learn, or about a meaning, or about a certain situation. Man, this is very common in the Arabic world, and I feel like I have seen it die. Because my grandparents and that generation, I hear them doing that thing. But my parents' generation, whether it's my uncles, the friends of these people, I don't see it. I see that culture has sort of like died. And I'm with you, man. We need to bring it back to life.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So on that note, can we hear some ghazal, please?
Okay, perfect. So this ghazal is like one of my favorite ghazals. I don't have a translation, but I'll try to find something for later. But if not, then just enjoy the melody. I'm going to read 4 to 5 verses from this one. It's by this poet called Haider Ali Atash. He says, Ye arzu thi tujhe gul ke rubaru karte, hum aur bulbule betab guftugu karte. پیامبر نہ میسر ہوا تو خوب ہوا پیامبر نہ میسر ہوا تو خوب ہوا زبان غیر سے کیا شرح آرزو کرتے. I want to talk a little bit about this if you guys don't mind. So this particular verse actually says پیامبر نہ میسر ہوا تو خوب ہوا. So the خوب ہوا is basically like an idiomatic use. Ghazals use a lot of idioms to actually localize the poetry because only, and it kind of makes it makes the pleasure exclusive to culture, right? And so in this specific expression, he says that a messenger like was not available to me. Oh, wow. You know, like as a sarcasm, like as a complaint to God.
Great. Like, you know, and how we say khub.
Yeah, khub. And zabane ghair se kya shareh arzu karte. So zabane ghair, he says that the tongue and the language that I use is the zabane ghair, is the language of like,
stranger.
You know, a stranger. Se kya shareh arzu karte. Shareh Sharh is basically like the word which is basically coming from Quran, again, from the prayer of the Moses. وَقَالَ رَبِّ شَحْلَ صَدْرِي وَيَسْلِمِ Oh God, expand my breast so that I can attain clarity. And he says that Sharh Arzu, so a lot of expressions are basically allusions which are coming from like far, far, far away. That's what I was saying. That, and you were saying earlier as well that there's so much to discover within the ghazal world. And Sharh Arzu is basically that how do I actually express or articulate my desire that it brings me clarity and with this tongue which actually speaks the language of the world, not my heart. So it's a complaint to kind of God, oh wow, you know, like what access you have given to me with it, and I cannot explain. And on top of that, what creates attention that arzu is a desire that is never fulfilled. So it's a paradox. I'm going to continue. And he says that meri tarha se maho mehar bhi hai avara. Just like me, the sun and the moon, basically, they are also like a avara, like a, they are like moving, like they're wayfarers. Kisi habib ki ye bhi hai justuju karte. Like just like me, they are also in pursuit of the beloved. And I think I'm gonna conclude with this, with the last line. Ki na pooch alame bargashta talae atish barasti aag jo bara ke arzu karte. If you look at the first line of it. He's saying to his beloved that I desire to place you right next to an ideal, the flower, the beauty. Ye arzu thi ki tujhe gul ke rubaru karte. That I place you in right in front of, you should face and look at that I'm comparing you to an ideal, to a beauty. And hum aur bulbule betab, and I and the nightingale, which is like restless in love, would actually talk about you. So basically when I was saying that, you know, in the ghazal world, they're actually like these portals. The universes are created where you have a lover and a beloved, and everything mimics our world. And this poem, the first line, is a very good example that he's saying that, you know, like, I wish to use that universe, and I wish I could take you into that poetic universe to actually tell you what I really mean. And I could actually talk to a nightingale who's in love with the bulbul, just like I am in love with you. So this is a very good representation of like you know, how the universes and ghazals work.
I love it. I feel like a ghazal writer is a person of metal. Like, you know, they've been through a journey, a struggle, and then they're writing. So like, as a writer, it doesn't sound like someone who's got low self-esteem, you know, in simple words. You know what I mean? Like the way you're explaining it, and even in Urdu, the way it...
Well, there's a lot of chauvinism, by the way, in the world of ghazal writers. They say when the people who write ghazals, they're like, oh, I'm not just a poet.
Exactly.
I'm a ghazal writer. See?
So, I'm a fucking shit.
Yeah, that's what a ghazal writer is. So if you want to be the fucking shit...
write some ghazal.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with Faraz and Namal on the Poetry Hood podcast. If you wish to learn more about Faraz and the work that he is doing, make sure to check the links in the description. Also, we have a Patreon page for the Poetry Hood. For over 5 years, I have spent many hours and lots of money to keep the Poetry Hood community alive. I have no assistant, no staff, no interns. A thoroughly one-man labor of love. If this labor has added value to your life, please consider aiding its sustenance with a loyal donation. Your support makes all the difference. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.